It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many businesses are just now starting the long process of getting back to normal as the pandemic shut down huge parts of our state and region's economy. What will it take for an economic rebound in the Pittsburgh area? Stephanie Pashman is CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Stephanie, how are you feeling about Pittsburgh's recovery chances? Optimistic, cautious, uncertain, none of the above?
Look, cautiously optimistic. I think we have some really good advantages in Pittsburgh. We have a really strong health system with ample capacity to handle anything that may come. And I think we see during the pandemic how manageable it was for us with lower case levels, compliance with rules and regulations, mask wearing, PPE. We have coordinated contact tracing. We also have a shared commitment to stay open, not just get open. And we have people actively committed to supporting our local, our small businesses, supporting our Main Street establishments. And that is certainly going to help us. We are a resilient community. We've done this before. And so I think we're positioned to do it again.
How important is that? Not just the commitment to get open again, but how difficult is it to stay open and succeed?
So staying open means businesses have to think about restructuring their workplaces to make sure that there is space and protection for their employees, be mindful of cleaning procedures. We also are thinking about restructuring how we operate our restaurants, closing streets so they can put outdoor dining in. And finally, it's about individual compliance. People have to wear those masks, they have to stay distant, and they have to follow the rules. And as an overall front, I think our region has been, you know, pretty good at doing that.
It's only been a little over a decade since our last economic recession. Is there anything different about this one in trying to get out of that recession?
Yeah, so I think that we did some analysis to try and understand what we could learn from prior downturns into this one. And I think one thing that's pretty clear is that this is very, very, very different. This is very unprecedented. It's not sector specific. It's not region specific. I mean, so the steel downturn was you know, concentrated on regions as an example. The dot-com bust was concentrated on an industry. This is very, very different. And it was induced by essentially policy interventions and behaviors that were aimed at controlling the virus and looking at the public health framework for how we combat COVID.
So what are some of the biggest obstacles that our region faces in a recovery?
So I think one of the key obstacles that we all understand is that there is no playbook for this one. And because it is so unique and because the dynamics are so unique and is so large at scale, we have to just be creative and try new ways to move forward. The public health experts do not completely understand how this disease is going to progress and how we expect it to play out over the next several months. So we're dealing with a lot of unknowns, but we have to get people back to work. We have to help our small businesses recover. We have to focus on equitable community development to make sure that we are inclusive and everybody is kind of getting opportunity to move forward. We have to make sure that we make the investments in PPE and equipment that we need to produce. Those are just some specific examples.
What causes you maybe the most concern?
I think my biggest concern is just the statistic that 1 in 4 working Americans lost their jobs during this period. That's a pretty astounding stat. And those people losing their jobs across a variety of skill sets. And what we see is the combination of the number of people out of work combined with the rethinking of how we're going to do business creates a lot of unknowns for how we think about where we put those people back into the workforce and how quickly we're able to make it happen as we are simultaneously repositioning and trying to reemploy. That is very, very challenging.
According to a recent study from the University of Pittsburgh's Municipal Finance Research Collaborative, municipalities across the state, particularly in southwestern Pennsylvania, will likely lose millions and millions in revenue due to the economic effects of the pandemic. How can the county weather these changes, especially its impact on its municipal governments?
So as you know, the Allegheny Conference has a 10-county footprint. And so we are looking at this dynamic playing out in municipalities, not just in Allegheny County, but in Lawrence County and Indiana and beyond. And the number of municipalities that are currently there likely can't survive with the ability to invest in independent police forces, independent human services operations, public health operations. And so we're going to likely see a lot more municipal collaboration and shared services models. And that's something we're actually trying to understand and look at, whether it's, you know, water authorities or just the operations of day-to-day government. How do we make sure that there's, you know, efficient operations across and facilitate some of that collaboration? We likely were going to see reallocation of funds to different types of programming. For example, the public health, you know, infrastructure may have to be bolstered, and that will come at the expense of some other kind of service that we're seeing. And we're also going to have to rely on state reform and potentially federal reform to drive resources and drive ideas and allow for flexibility and creativity within structuring at the municipal level.
What's the role of the conference in those kind of changes?
So the conference, number one, we are a conduit for information and understanding. So we make sure, and, you know, during this pandemic, that was one of the key roles we played, is we had, you know, a weekly call with our 10 county economic development partners. And the purpose of that is for us to be able to make sure that they are provided the most available up-to-date information, whether it's on public policy or, you know, what we're hearing from the business community here, but also that we're appreciating the challenges they are facing that may be unique to their region and their area. And so we want to make sure that we have an appreciation of each county's unique dynamics and unique needs. So that's one piece. And we use that information then to drive problem solving, whether it's policy solutions, whether it's educational webinars, whether it's, you know, bringing people together to try and solve problems together. Our main job, I think, is about connecting and convening for the purpose of civic problem solving.
Stephanie, a year from now, where do you think Pittsburgh's economy will be? Does that all depend on whether there's a second wave of COVID in the fall and winter?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kevin. I wish I had a crystal ball, but I think I'd like to think in a year, number one, we'll know a lot more about this virus. Maybe we'll have a treatment, maybe we'll have a vaccine, and we'll be very close to it, which will give people, you know, a much different approach to our day-to-day lives. We'll also have adjusted to a new normal. We'll have stabilized certain aspects of our economy, not just our downtown business community, but our arts and culture, our sports and food, the solvency of municipalities will be something we'll have wrestled with. Hopefully our nonprofits will have a capacity to come back to life and be able to be, you know, supporting our community needs. And we also will have a strong recovery plan that's aligned with actions and growth. I mean, that's one of the things we know from the conference is that we're already at a place where we're investing in creating that recovery plan and thinking about what new ideas can emerge from this. And we also would like to think that innovation will begin to happen. We're starting to see a lot of interesting ideas starting to spawn out of our universities and out of our, you know, startup and entrepreneurial, you know, community here that'll spawn some new ideas and new thinking. And hopefully we can capitalize on the layers of innovation, on collaboration, and then the resilience get to a better place and a transformational place for this region.
Finally, what's at the top? What's number one at that plan that you mentioned?
I think number one is making sure that people have an understanding that it's okay to go outside, it's okay to go back to work, and that we are safe to do that. And that, I think, consumer confidence and individual confidence and appreciation that it's okay and we can keep you safe and you can still go to your job and you can still visit your grandma and you can still, you know, go to a restaurant and eat or find some sort of outdoor entertainment. We want to make sure that people are starting to get that confidence to get back out. And that is critical right now.
Stephanie Pashman is the CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. It was wonderful to be with you today.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The need for masks, gowns, and other personal protective equipment for healthcare workers and those on the front lines of the coronavirus outbreak has soared over the last couple of months, leading to shortages across the country. But what if some PPE could be used multiple times? Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh have created a textile coating that repels liquids like blood and saliva, and they say can also prevent some viruses from adhering to the surface. Paul Liu is an associate professor in industrial engineering at Pitt. Paul, was the coating already being used to repel fluids? And you said, I wonder if this could block viruses.
Yeah, so we have been testing the coating on various bodily fluids, things like saliva and blood. And then we had also been testing proteins as well. And since we were testing proteins, that's what led us to think maybe we should test this on viruses as well. Viruses have a protein-coated structure, and that's what they use to adhere to different surfaces.
Healthcare workers' equipment has to hold up to rigorous disinfection. Can the material that is coated withstand the sanitation processes of a hospital?
So that's been one of the key challenges with these types of coatings. Can it be durable? So in our tests, we've focused on mechanical abrasion. So we used Scotch-Brite surface, similar to that surface that you find in your kitchen with a Scotch-Brite sponge. We did fairly harsh abrasion on the surfaces where the coating was able to withstand that. We also have done some very harsh and aggressive ultrasonic washing of the surfaces, and it's also withstood that washing up to 12 cycles. We're currently trying to look at additional disinfection processes, things such as using an autoclave that hospitals use for disinfecting reusable textiles.
So you've tested the coating to see if it repels some type of adenovirus, I believe, that can cause acute respiratory disease as well as conjunctivitis. But have you been able to actually test it on the new coronavirus, which causes COVID-19?
We have not tested it on SARS-CoV-2. There are a few labs at University of Pittsburgh that are working on this, but they, I believe, are extremely busy evaluating vaccines and looking at how this virus spreads. So our current plan is to focus on beta coronaviruses. So it's type of virus that's similar, but not quite as dangerous to work with.
So how realistic is that this coating could actually help healthcare workers in the near term?
So we do, even though we haven't tested it directly on SARS-CoV-2, we do think that it is likely to be able to repel this because SARS-CoV-2 is transmitted through respiratory droplets, and the coating can repel droplets from saliva. And currently we are talking to some textile manufacturers as well as healthcare providers in seeing how we can realize this coating for actual healthcare application.
When might you realistically expect personal protective gear, personal protective equipment to be coated with this material?
I mean, certainly we want to work on this immediately and get this out as soon as possible. But a lot of that really depends on working with industrial partners and healthcare provider partners. There may also be some restrictions in terms of FDA approval. So there is a process that all of this needs to go through. I think if we could get something out within a month or two, I think that would be great.
Paul Liu is an associate professor in industrial engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Building friendships with other kids is an important part of childhood, but the pandemic has meant that many children haven't seen other kids their own age in months. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has released guidance for daycares, it's been silent on playdates. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden finds out whether it's possible to safely allow kids to visit with friends.
I talked to three pediatricians for this story. There are no easy answers.
Recognize that everything you do that's outside of you being outside of your home comes with increased risk.
Dr. Todd Woolen, CEO of Kids Plus Pediatrics in Pittsburgh, says whether to resume playdates is a personal choice. But he did give some recommendations. Limit get-togethers to kids from just a couple families who you know are taking COVID-19 precautions seriously. Stick to outdoor activities where kids are able to stay 6 feet apart.
Indoor, younger kids, maybe no mask wearing, risks go up.
But as I saw this weekend, it's nearly impossible to explain to small children that they need to stay separate from each other.
I'm going blue. What's that blue down there?
2-year-old Oscar and his friend Desmond, also 2, are drawing in the yard with blue chalk. It's drizzling a little, but the boys don't seem to care.
Desmond, can you share the chalk?
Desmond's mom, Nia Baton-Sofieri, says she knows her son misses kids his own age because when they walk by his daycare, he cries and asks for his friends.
For him to just kind of be mumbling about all of his friends and wanting to go see, and not be able to was really heartbreaking.
Baton-Sofieri says she waited a couple months after Desmond's daycare closed to schedule his first play date with Oscar. Oscar's mom, Katie Clark, says both boys hadn't been around other kids for a while, and at first, they seemed nervous.
They were, like, separate for a little while. Like, when we had play dates before the pandemic, they would, like, start chasing each other right away, or they immediately knew what to do. And it didn't seem like that.
Dr. Joseph Arakri is the chair of pediatrics at Allegheny Health Network. He says he's noticed that kids have been acting out more when they come to his office for medical care, something he attributes to how scary life has become in the last few months.
It's time to start to normalize things. And you could do that in a very safe, cautious manner, but the kids need to interact. This is not natural.
Arakri agrees that outside activities are safest and advises that parents have kids wash their hands and faces before playing.
I would not require kids to mask because I just think it's horrible for them.
Obviously, if a child, caregiver, or sibling is immunocompromised, the health risk posed by a playdate might be too high. Arakri's concern is that prohibiting peer-to-peer interactions stunts a child's psychosocial development.
Especially kids that are going from, like, 2 to 4 years of age, they are going from the separation of the parents to developing play structures and learning how to negotiate with each other. And we have to make sure that that developmentally occurs.
Dr. Abigail Schlesinger is the chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at UPMC's Children's Hospital. She says the pandemic, in all of its unknowns, present an opportunity for parents to model for kids how to evaluate and tolerate risk and uncertainty.
We're making choices. This is what we do to help keep ourselves safe. If things change, we may change what we're doing.
While COVID-19 cases and deaths are declining in Pennsylvania, the pandemic is not over. The role children have in spreading the coronavirus is not known. An epidemiologist warned that a second surge remains a real possibility. So, while Schlesinger is worried about how the pandemic is affecting the emotional well-being of kids and families, she says holding off on playdates is a legitimate choice.
In 1918, in the pandemic, they didn't have all these other things we have, right? And we didn't see an entire generation worth of people with no psychosocial skills.
That's because a kid's most important relationships are with their parents. So if you're playing with your child and making sure they feel safe and loved, Schlesinger says they will be okay. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joey Zenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.